This edition of Midori House was first broadcast on the 22nd of February 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House here on Monocle 24, coming to you live from Studio One here in London with me, Tyler Brulé. Coming up over the next 60 minutes, six world powers are meeting in Kazakhstan on Monday to discuss Iran's nuclear program. But will the talks yield any progress? Shashank Joshi and Steve Bloomfield weigh in. Steve?
So long as they keep talking, so as they start talking, that's something.
Okay.
It's really that simple.
Much more to unpack there. We're also going to be checking in with our senior editor, Sophie Grove, in Gaziantep, Turkey, and we'll take a tour of a new men's store just around the corner from our New York bureau.
Most customers, the first time they come in, they're a little caught off guard because it's not what they would expect. But after a few minutes of engaging with them, you know, I think they find that the sense of self-discovery in here is kind of refreshing.
All that, plus some of Monocle's editors join us to run through the week's stories. We might even squeeze in a song as well, too, right here on Midori House, live from London on Monocle 24. And good evening from Studio One here at Midori House in London. A lot to get through over the next 58 minutes and 30 seconds here out of London. Before all of that, though, here is David Spencer with the news.
South African Olympian and Paralympian Oscar Pistorius has been released from custody on bail after a lengthy hearing in Pretoria. Over the last few days, the defence and prosecution in his murder case have presented evidence. The athlete's lawyers successfully argued he was too famous to pose a flight risk. Pistorius denies murdering Reva Steenkamp, saying he shot her by mistake. Magistrate Desmond Nair said he was surprised by the detail in the athlete's affidavit.
Ordinarily, one gets flimsy affidavits merely saying, I deny the allegations, I will not flee. But in this instance, the accused has reached out to try to meet the state case. Of course, against the background of those improbabilities that I have seen and mentioned.
The European Commission has warned that the Eurozone won't return to growth until 2014. Today's report also said Spain, Portugal and France will miss debt-cutting targets as a result. Paris and Lisbon said they would seek more time from Brussels to reach their deficit goals. Madrid has already indicated the same. EU Economic and Monetary Affairs Commissioner Olli Rehn outlined their figures.
Our projections for this year is that there will be zero growth in the European Union as a whole and minus 0.3% GDP growth in the euro area.
Britain's food regulator says it's found another 35 positive tests for horse meat in beef products, confirming the latest contaminations in a scandal still spreading across Europe. The Food Standards Agency said these products had already been named and withdrawn from sale. Today, the food company Birdseye withdrew three meat products from sale in Britain and Ireland after traces of horse DNA were found in a ready meal sold in Belgium. Dock workers have shut down the movement of global commodities throughout Brazilian ports during a six-hour strike. They've been protesting against the government's plan to overhaul regulations and put more than 150 terminals in the hands of the private sector. The short stoppage provided a glimpse of what could turn out to be a tense harvest for Brazil, with more strikes possible at one of the world's biggest exporters of agricultural crops. Heavy rain has flooded homes and caused travel chaos in Athens. Several hours of rainfall led to underpasses and a central subway station in the Greek capital being closed, while some parked cars were swept away in the deluge. Madonna has been named the biggest moneymaker in music in 2012, with a world tour helping her take home up to $34.6 million. The 54-year-old topped Billboard magazine's annual list of top music moneymakers, ahead of Bruce Springsteen and Pink Floyd's Roger Waters in a distant third. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much for that, David. A little bit more from you at the bottom of the hour, 26 minutes from now. Just some business news at the moment. The Nikkei Shimbun is reporting that some of Japan's biggest retail brands are starting to invest in Silicon Valley businesses in order to become more agile at analyzing and unearthing big data. Convenience store giant Lawson is one of the names leading the charge. Also, it's an aviation news. It's not all bad news at Boeing at the moment. Air Transport World is reporting that Lufthansa subsidiary Swiss might be on the verge of purchasing 6 777-300ERs as part of their long-haul fleet renewal. This would make for a big win for Boeing, as that aircraft is currently not part of the Lufthansa Group's fleet currently. Also in Canada, in retail news at the moment, data suggesting that it wasn't such a great December. Retail sales in Canada dipped about 2%. Also looks like it's not going to be great news for retailer Nordstrom, due to enter the Canadian market shortly as well. They're saying they're going to miss their profit targets. And also in retail news, Bloomberg is reporting right now that LVMH, of course, the parent company of the likes of Louis Vuitton, Celine, etc., might have Burberry and Tiffany in its acquisition sites. A little bit of business news there. It's just 3:06 if you're listening in Tokyo. It is 18:06 here in London. It's 10:06 in the morning in Vancouver. You're listening to Midori House.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
Op London, du er Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London, Europe,
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London. London.
This is Monocle 24.
And you are back with Monocle 24. You are listening to Midori House. I'm joined by our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, who joins me in studio at the moment. Steve, at the top of the program, you were talking about all that is underway in Kazakhstan at the moment regarding disarmament or potential disarmament talks anyway. I'm also joined by Shashank Joshi as well. But maybe set the stage for us.
So the talks are going to happen. At least we hope they're really going to happen in Almaty, in Kazakhstan. This is the they're called the E3+3. Some people call them the G5+1. But basically, what we need to know is it's US, it's China, it's Russia, it's France, it's Germany, it's the UK and Iran. And the idea is, at some stage, hopefully, there'll be some sort of agreement. But frankly, that's not going to happen. We should just be pleased that talks are happening.
Mm. Last time, Shashank, it was about 9 months ago, 10 months ago?
Last summer, yeah, we had a round of talks in Moscow, which collapsed acrimoniously. And we haven't had anything since until
what
now.
What did that sound or look like?
Well, what happened is, what the West wants pretty much is something called stop, shut and ship. We want Iran to stop enriching uranium to 20%, which counterintuitively is 9/10 of the way to weapons grade. Mm. We want them to send their stockpiles out the country and shut down their big Bond-like underground enrichment site at Fordo. And Iran said, OK, we'll do all of that if you lift all the sanctions first. And we said, come off it, that's completely absurd. This is only an opening step. This is a confidence building measure, not a complete settlement. So nothing's happened since then. The US elections got in the way. Mm. And, you know, as Steve suggested, even having talks in the first place is a bit of a success now.
I just want to go to Almaty and Kazakhstan as a venue, not a particularly long flight from Tehran, but anything, and to both of you, anything significant in this, just nice neutral territory, or perhaps that one doesn't have to burn up too much jet fuel to get there?
We wanted Istanbul. The Iranians said something absurd like Baghdad or Damascus, and we thought, okay, all right, Almaty is a sensible compromise. Last year we had them in Moscow, Istanbul and Baghdad. So this is just about okay for everyone concerned.
I mean, go ahead, Steve.
No, I was just going to say, the one other thing about Kazakhstan is it's a country which used to have nuclear weapons and was quite happy to have the West help them deal with that issue. So I don't know whether we can see that as an omen, but it's certainly a little bit of symbolism, perhaps.
I mean, is part of this also just dipping in to almost visit your neighbors, checking in on how they're doing? Interesting. This is about keeping just the dialogue going. We should be happy that they've managed to rock up in Kazakhstan at this lovely time of year to be in Kazakhstan as well.
Well, it's good they've met, but the problem is the clock is ticking in some respects. Israel last year suggested its red line for the Iranian nuclear program was when Iran would accumulate 240 kilograms of uranium enriched at 20%. Now, the last report from the IAEA came out yesterday, in fact, showed that Iran now has roughly 100 167 kilograms. So we're still a way away. But the problem is at some point they will run into this line and then Israel has a choice. Do they bomb or do they lose credibility?
There's also a domestic politics issue. Now, normally when we talk of domestic politics and the Iran issue, we're talking about Israeli domestic politics and we talk about US domestic politics. But Iran has an election in June. Now, it's not going to be free and it's not going to be fair. But, you know, a lot of people will be voting. And it's interesting to note and it's important to remember that there is not a liberal, the liberal Iran that we see also believes that Iran should have a nuclear program of some sort, maybe not a weapons program, but certainly a nuclear power program. We had Hushang Amir Rakhmadi, who in here last week, I think it was, who's the sort of the Iranian presidential candidate that everyone in the West loves. And even he was saying, well, look, you know, we still want to have some sort of a program. We don't like the idea of America in particular saying to us, you can't do that.
Even the Green Revolutionaries all wanted a nuclear program. Mir Hossein Mousavi, the candidate who was under house arrest after the protest, you know, he was one of the leaders of the nuclear program in the 80s.
At these talks, who is really leading the charge?
For once, it's the Europeans. It's Cathy Ashton, head of the European Union's sort of foreign service. And she's putting together all these really discrepant positions. But ultimately, everyone knows the actor that can really give Iran the concessions it needs, the actor who matters above all, is the United States, which is why the prospect of direct US-Iran talks looms over this entire process.
And right now, with a change of course, musical chairs right now at the State Department as well, do you think that there's also a little bit of maneuvering, perhaps, on the part of Washington to see how this team performs and, you know, potentially also just, you know, what types of strings are being pulled in the background by Mr. Kerry?
I think they're going to be slightly on the back foot, actually, because, I mean, John Kerry may be, you know, the sort of person that would be willing to negotiate. I'm fairly sure he would be willing to do pretty much whatever he could if it meant that there was a proper deal and he would have a legacy secured. But I think the fact that Iran has played a major part in the hearings over Chuck Hagel's nomination for Secretary of Defense has meant that the US administration has really had to reiterate just how strongly they defend Israel and just how strongly they are against Iran having any sort of nuclear program, that it means there's very little wriggle room for them.
Sure, Shashank, go ahead.
No, I think that's absolutely right. And I think the big question now is the West able to offer Iran sanctions relief, because that's what it will take to eventually secure this restriction. I think it's worth pointing out, no one is now realistically asking Iran to shut down its nuclear program. We did once want that, and technically, go back to the UN Security Council, that's what they want. Everyone now privately accepts Iran is going to have some degree of enrichment of uranium on its soil. The only question is, can we cap it? And I think that's the right way to look at the question.
Sorry.
I completely agree.
do you think this at least ends on, there's a bit of an uptick or a positive note this time out, you know, referencing, you know, where Israel might be sitting at the moment, but who returns home feeling somewhat victorious, do you think, Shashank?
I think keep your expectations low. Most diplomats understand that, you know, this is one round. The Iranian elections, as Steve mentioned, meant that the Iranian system isn't able to come to a consensus on this. Khamenei isn't going to endorse any wild wedge issues at this sensitive time. So actually, I think we recognize it will take until after June, after the Iranian elections, to really break through. Success would be having both sides not at each other's throats at the end of next week.
Steve?
If there is another meeting arranged by the end of this meeting, then everyone will go home happy.
Right.
Everyone's a winner. Steve Bluefield and Shashank Joshi, Research Fellow at the Royal United Services Institute, also in its short form known as RUSI. Coming up, we have two of our editors going to be taking me through the stories of the week right here on Monocle 24.
If we use, dear listeners, the metaphor of Monocle 24 as an online radio amusement park, then Culture with me, Robert Bound, is the roller coaster.
We are finally on the train, on the sexy contemporary art train.
Scaling the heights of artistic endeavour to look out across a picturesque international landscape dotted with galleries, live music venues, outdoor screenings of wonderful movies being scrutinised and applauded by appreciative audiences. Marvel at the view. Strap yourself in. Scream, ladies and gentlemen, if you want to go faster. We're just one metaphor away from a meltdown. On the latest edition, we fight off the paparazzi and lose the entourage to chat with one of Japan's biggest pop stars. Get keen on Kino at the Berlin Film Festival and take a trip to that unlikely art enclave, Tasmania, you devils.
We had a drummer who was submerged in the Derwent and playing underwater for 15 minutes, thrashing away with metal drumsticks on a kit that had hydrofoams on it with a scuba mask on.
That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
Inspiration comes from finding new ventures that combine traditions with an original contemporary approach, especially when it comes to food. Monocle Films visits Toronto, Lisbon, and Thessaloniki to discover some sweet recipes for success.
Nadege, along with her small but dedicated crew of pastry chefs, create every morsel on-site in a large open kitchen connected to the main dining area. It's here that they balance flavour with colour, texture with geometry, and creativity with shelf appeal.
Taste with your eyes on monocle.com.
And welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24, just 18:15 in London, 13:15 in New York. We're going to be crossing over to the southeast of Turkey right now. Our senior editor, Sophie Grove, is standing by. She is on assignment for us, and she is in Gaziantep at the moment. Sophie, hello.
Hi there. Hi.
Tell us, without giving too much away, but we don't want the whole story written, but what are you up to in that corner of Turkey at the moment?
So I'm about 40 miles from the border with Syria, and Gaziantep is an incredibly industrial area. In fact, I'm overlooking sort of industrial heartland, not the most beautiful view, but really this is becoming a very interesting hotspot in Turkey, mainly because NATO has deployed here, and there are some very interesting air defence installations all the way down the border, really guarding some of the towns in this region. And it's called the Patriot System. They're sort of really sort of very sophisticated NATO weapons provided by a couple of the NATO members, including the Dutch and the Germans and the US. And we were looking at them today, and it's really looking at how NATO is rallying to protect Turkey, but also what this really means and what the threat is, what the situation on the border is.
I mean, the Patriot missile has become incredibly symbolic, has it not, Sophie? Really, as a symbol of serious geopolitical flare-up. And I can remember doing a phone-in, not dislike this one that you're doing now, from Okinawa last year when I was there, and the Japanese were deploying their Patriot missiles at the time. Obviously, when things when the North Koreans sent their rocket over Japan, it didn't quite work out the way the North Koreans wanted it to. But same thing here. I wanted to ask you, these Patriot batteries that have been set up, are they there to really protect from an overflight of a potential missile that might come out of Syria, which is it will be heading towards Ankara or to Istanbul potentially, or is it there to protect all of the baklava production?
Well, exactly. I mean, I think the capability of these missiles is quite immense. But they say that they're just here to protect this quite considerable population of 2 million people in Gaziantep and then 2 million people across down in Adana, which, it is a sizable population in a very, very important area, close to the border. But they can take out planes. They were developed in the 80s to take out planes and helicopters, and these really are to take out any Scud missiles. And they know that Assad's regime is using Scud missiles across the border. On their radars, they can see that. There are warships in the Mediterranean monitoring that, and the radars here have an incredible capability of monitoring the Scud missiles. So they're looking at those rockets, and if any of them come anywhere, or look like they're heading towards the Turkish airspace, this whole sort of string of defence, air defence, will take those out. They are symbolic.
Is this a true NATO exercise, or is this just a case of America deploying their Patriots, or do we really see sort of a locking of hands of all NATO members manning these batteries?
It's a true NATO alliance. I mean, visited the Dutch, they were sort of very laid back, sort of making chairs out of, you know, containers and reading novels in the dappled sun. And then we came down to the US facility, completely different culture. But they were all sort of collaborating and donating the Patriot systems that they own. And only a certain amount of countries own the Patriot systems. You know, Japan is one and Korea is another, but we, you know, within Europe, you know, the Germans and the Dutch are the only people that possess that capability. So they've come to the fore. There is some wrangling over who's paying for this, and it's quite a hot topic. I mean, Turkey have invited their NATO allies to come to the border, and you know, alienated quite a lot of people in the process. But actually, you know, the NATO thinks they should foot the bill, and it looks like they're not totally prepared to, so we'll have to watch that space.
Mm. And just before we go, is that going to be a topic of discussion? I gather that there's a number of NATO ministry of, well, certainly ministers of defense. Also, Frau Merkel is going to be in the area as well.
Yes, we're going to a conference tomorrow with the Dutch Minister of Defence and his German counterpart. And on Sunday, Angela Merkel is flying in too. So there's some high-profile people busing in, and a lot of NATO press sects around the place in Brussels. And, you know, a lot of speculation. The Turkish population particularly are very suspicious of the Patriots. Some people say, well, this is waking up a target. This isn't just here for a defence system. This is here for create a no-fly zone, you know, what's going on. So I think that the MOD presence will be good. It will clarify the position of these patriots.
Excellent. Our editor, Sophie Grove in Gaziantep, Turkey, make sure you don't get too close to any of those missile batteries, at least not the back end of them anyway. You're listening to Midori House. It's 21 past the hour of 1800 here in London. We're going to be crossing over to talk to our transport editor in New York. It's a little bit of a Dreamliner update right after this.
Vanuit London. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, eu sou London. This is Monocle 24.
Ot London, tu é Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London. London.
This is Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24, 1822 here in London, 1322 in New York. I believe it's that time in our bureau as well, and it is time to have a little bit of an update. Tristan, we've been watching the wires and the screens in our office and various news flashing that Boeing is about to announce something of a fix. We're told it's an interim fix for the 787 Dreamliner. What are you hearing in New York right now?
Well, Tyler, we haven't really seen the exact items that will be on that list, but we're seeing, according to the Wall Street Journal and some other sources here in the U.S., that there will be 10 points on this list, and the head of Boeing Commercial Airplanes is supposed to travel from Washington State to Washington, D.C. today to get in front of lawmakers and decision makers and make the case that they have some workarounds and some ways to solve the issues that seem to have been plaguing the infancy of this aircraft.
Over the last 48 hours, looking at various transport websites and certainly news sites. So there's a discussion about there might be special thermometers that are going to be installed. There's going to be a new type of housing to go around these batteries in case there is another fire, which sound like massive and rather soggy band-aids.
Well, it remains to be seen what, if anything, will be allowed to be a temporary fix. You know, when we look at airplanes, we often have to be sure beyond a reasonable doubt that nothing will go wrong in the sky. And as transportation authorities were saying when these things were first grounded, having a fire on an airplane or anything overheat is probably one of the worst things that can possibly happen. So, you know, we're looking at two things here. First of all, we have the speculation of short-term fixes, you know, what can get these planes back in the air as soon as possible. And then beyond that, what long-term fixes to be sure that the planes that are being built now and then the ones that have been built can all be retrofitted to be absolutely sure that this isn't even a possible scenario? And that's a very, very tough question. And again, a lot of this is off the record. A lot of this is hearsay. So we don't know exactly what these fixes are going to be. But chances are that the FAA and NTSB are going to be pretty gun shy on allowing the planes to get back in the sky if they're not absolutely sure. Because if you'll remember, when they first grounded these things, the FAA got a lot of flack from the public, from the media, for standing by the idea that the plane was safe to fly and then eventually having to ground it. So, you know, it was hard in terms of public confidence.
We have an outgoing Transport Secretary, Ray LaHood, who's also going to be joining us on the program next week. If you're an outgoing Transport Secretary, I guess you also don't want your legacy to be that you let this thing go into to the air as well. So do you think also because we're in this transition period with all of these transport chiefs as well, also someone incoming, you know, at the same time, they want to establish a precedent. They're going to want to be tough. And of course, Boeing is at the cornerstone of USA Incorporated. It is one of, you know, one would argue one of the most important companies, you know, in the United States in terms of literally flying the flag. I'm wondering, you know, if what do you think the balance is between, of course, wanting to, you know, keep aircraft coming off the assembly line, but also wanting to be seen to do the right thing?
Well, I think at this point, the whole world is watching, and this is a very, very tough one because, as you said, Boeing, by dollar volume, is the largest exporter in the U.S. That's incredible when you think about the economic impact. And then in terms of a company that is leveraging its future on this aircraft, we need to be sure, everyone needs to be sure that this airplane, not, you know, from Brand America's perspective, that this airplane is safe, because if this were to happen again, if we had to pull back and say, they need to come out of the air again, and we need to go through this process again, I don't think it would bode very well for Boeing's brand, and in turn, you know, in industrial America as this shining light of next generation technology. So I think the tendency here is to be very gun shy and to really save face as much as possible, because I don't think this can afford many more blows.
Tristan McAllister, our transport editor in New York, I'm sure you'll probably be harassed by our editors here a little bit later in the day, because I'm sure this has developed, so you'll probably be making an appearance on the Monocle Daily at 2200 tonight. It is 26 minutes after the hour. We are going to be meeting our neighbors just around the corner from where Tristan McAllister is in a moment. You're listening to Midori House. Well, today we catch up with Fogg, a new menswear shop located just a few blocks from our New York bureau, lodged in a narrow strip just north of Soho that's housed everything from a mini factory to a mechanic's garage. Fogg's contemporary interior, pardon me, is alone worth a visit. But as we recently found out, it's the rarefied range of products on offer alongside the charming team behind the business that really merit a stop. Monocle's Barrett Austin recently caught up with Mark Kincaid, one of the partners behind Fogg, for a look at what's in store.
We're basically a men's select shop, so we offer kind of the gamut of men's apparel, accessories, lifestyle products. We mainly focus on British and Japanese designers, so we have DS Dundee from England, Laurel Reef Collection from Fred Perry, Made Noir. I'd say our customer base is back-end creatives mostly. The space has been described to me two ways, either somebody's perfect idea of a walk-in closet or the deprivation tank from Altered States. And the philosophy behind the design of the space kind of came about both organically and somewhat of our philosophies with making it very service-based. So there isn't a lot of exposure to the product actually when you first walk in. There's about 8 feet of exposed rack, and other than that, everything is behind these kind of solid black bays. So it really forces the client to pretty much engage with one of us in order to kind of explore more of our wares. You know, I think most customers, when the first time they come in, is they're a little caught off guard because it's not what they would expect. But after a few minutes of engaging with them, you know, I think they find that the sense of self-discovery in here is kind of refreshing. What led us to open Fogg was myself and partners have worked in the industry for the past 20 years. And it's such a cliche to say, but there was really no place in New York that we really enjoyed shopping outside of monobrand shops. So it really came about with us either interacting with clients in previous positions or us ourselves saying, you know, this would make sense to do something that we would enjoy shopping at and kind of change the retail landscape a little bit of what's offered here. It's an interesting area because we're kind of in a thoroughfare and it's just recently been more developed. We're literally left of center of Soho, so I kind of like being somewhat off the beaten path, and literally just north of Houston, it's a completely different world where it's a lot more neighborhood based. Some of my favorite haunts is in this neighborhood. We have an amazing cafe next to us, so it kind of creates more of a neighborhood feel. We just had an exhibit with an Italian-born New York-based photographer, Alessandro Simonetti, and we'll continue to do art projects and cultural projects like that, more printed matter. We'll definitely start to go deeper into kind of more esoteric Japanese and British lines. I think what we offer, there's definitely aesthetic value to it, but I think the real charm in what we have is in the fabrications, how they're made, where they're made, and the story behind it. You really can't get that casually shopping through. So I really wanted to create that environment that forced the client, at least on the first time around, to kind of engage with one of us and create that relationship between each other. With that being said, and the space is quite intimate, we had to design all these little reveals. So behind the accessories case here is actually the fitting room. And then in all these somewhat nooks and crannies, you have even more stock that's somewhat revealed and displayed. And I kind of saw the space as something that will continue to evolve as we go. So whatever's stuck behind here now might be there tomorrow, might be something else.
That was Mark Kincaid, one of the partners behind Fog in New York. Coming up in the next half hour of the program, we'll be getting into the pages of the new Deutschland-themed issue of Monocle, the current issue right now with the gummy bear on the cover. And we'll also find out what trends are lighting up the catwalks and runways of Milan Fashion Week with our fashion editor Takahiro Sato. But first, David Spencer is back with the news headlines.
Thank you. Oscar Pistorius has been released from custody after a lengthy bail hearing in Pretoria. A magistrate finally granted bail after 3 days of claims and counterclaims from the defence and prosecution. The athlete denies murdering Reeva Steenkamp, saying he shot her by mistake. The European Commission has warned that the Eurozone won't return to growth until 2014. Today's report also said Spain, Portugal and France will miss debt-cutting targets as a result. Britain's food regulator says it's found another 35 positive tests for horse meat in beef products, confirming the latest contaminations in a scandal still spreading across Europe. Meanwhile, food company Birdseye has withdrawn 3 meat products from sale in Britain and Ireland after traces of horse DNA were found in a ready meal sold in Belgium. Dock workers have shut down ports in Brazil during a 6-hour strike. They're protesting against the government's plan to overhaul regulations and put more than 150 terminals in the hands of the private sector. In Spain, hundreds of police have been deployed to Barajas Airport in Madrid because of demonstrations by striking Iberia workers. They're opposed to a restructuring plan that will axe 3,800 jobs and cut salaries. The week-long strike has caused hundreds of flights to be cancelled. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much for that, David. More from you in about 27 minutes' time. In a moment, we're going to delve into our new German-themed issue, as I was just saying before the bulletin. But here's something from my days at university in Vermont, something that was played again and again and again on the cassette player. This is P. Machinery's Propaganda. And that was Propaganda with P Machinery. Yes, a song that played again and again and again. And something that proved, at least in, this is what, probably the late 1980s, when a lot of my friends were saying that Germany wasn't doing great pop music. I would certainly pop in a bit of Propaganda. Anyway, that was them there. We're going to continue, though, with a German theme in a moment when we crack the cover of our current German-themed issue. Stay with us. Mm-hmm. It is just 1936. If you're listening in Berlin, it's 1836 here in London all this week on Midori House. We've been taking a look at the new German-themed issue of Monocle that hit newsstands yesterday, probably hitting most newsstands across Germany today, in fact. In the issue, we explore the role of modern Germany and examine how the rest of the world views Germans. Well, joining me now are Frank Jahn, ARD Television's correspondent here in London, and Uwe Rau, the deputy director of the Goethe Institute in London. Of course, two of the more recognizable brands, certainly in the sphere of communications and culture. I wanted to really start with you, Frank, because you came into the studio flashing around a copy of the Süddeutsche Zeitung, which did a story about not just Monocle, but also some of the other UK titles that have been covering not just brand Germany, but also the sort of the German psyche in general. And I do have to give full credit as well. You beat them to it. Maybe that's where they stole the idea from, because you were in here doing something a little bit earlier with our editors. Why, though, do you think there is this fascination, just because suddenly Monocle and The Spectator and The Economist write these stories about the country, that that the German media wants to unpack them and maybe sort of want to beat their chest a little bit and feel good about them, but at the same time do a lot of soul searching at the same time? Why do you think that is?
Well, I think from a journalistic point, it's quite a surprise. I mean, you're, as a journalist, you're always looking for news, for something new, and you took me by surprise with your cover and saying the world needs Germany. That is surprising news for Germany, and that's why we are interested in learning more about it. That's why I did this report on your issue.
But is this just false modesty? Because one only has to look at the number of cars that certainly the likes of BMW are selling in China, and no one really sort of needs to be convinced. You know, China certainly wants more Germany and all kinds of other things that are not just offered up by the major corporations, but also the Deutsche Mittelstand that we cover a lot in the issue as well.
No, I'm aware that some people might think that Germany is a powerhouse, economic powerhouse in Europe, but that doesn't necessarily mean that British people consider Germans as likable. I mean, that's not the same. So there's a slight difference.
No, which is why we try to soften everything by putting a gummy bear on the cover. And Uwe, I'm wondering the role of the Goethe Institute, not just in London, but also your missions around the world as well. As the German business model has come good, this notion that here is a country that just didn't, you know, run wholeheartedly after, you know, just a service sector, but said, yes, you know, it's still good to have apprenticeships. It's still good to make things. Has that changed the uptake and certainly the interest that non-Germans have had in what the Institute has to offer?
Oh, it certainly has. We here in London, we have a very big language department. And for the first time, we have more than 2,300 participants. The enrollments were as high as never, which is for us a little bit surprising. But then when we ask our students why they do learn German, they come up with different answers than they used to do. And one answer is that they are really interested in learning the language for professional development and also for potential benefits in mastering the knowledge of German.
Now, I have to ask you, are these predominantly Brits who are interested, or are these Spaniards who are in London hoping to get a job in Germany?
Well, actually, it is predominantly Brits, but as London is so multicultural and so international, I would say one quarter, one third of our students are non-Brits. So.
Do you think perceptions have changed, though? And you know, one thing that I talked when I was speaking to the journalists from the Süddeutsche Zeitung is, you know, I often sort of just get so annoyed with the British press that it's still okay to. Still okay to bash the Germans and give them a good thumping. The tabloid press, you know, love to do that, but they couldn't get away with doing that. You know, you couldn't do that to Pakistan. You know, you couldn't have a go at Egypt in the same way. But Germany is fair game. Do you think, Uwe, that there's a softening as well in terms of perceptions, and that not saying that Germany is necessarily a more cuddly brand, but certainly one which is more aspirational?
I think there is definitely a softening, and I think if there is a criticism, it's sort of a more ironical or lovable criticism. And I think one of the main examples is, for example, was the football game last week, Arsenal and Bayern München. The commentaries were positive, or they were adequate, I would say. And I talked to my colleagues at the Institute, actually, because we have some programs learning German and playing football, and they are saying it would have been the case like this 10 years ago or 8 years ago. It would have been much more aggressive and more German bashing. Mm. So I definitely think it has softened. And what people say here, I think we talked that with our colleagues from RD and other people, I think the World Cup, the Football World Cup, has changed
definitely
significantly the perception of Germany.
Frank, tell me, working in a bureau and on one side, you know, representing one of the biggest news and media organizations in Germany, have you also found that the outreach on the part of British PR companies and those who want to get in front of your cameras, you know, has also become more pronounced as well? That there's this greater outreach to Germany, people wanting their potentially British stories, or also people in other bureaus around the world working for ARD, have found that yes, people recognize the scale of this economy and they want to make sure that their stories are being told.
Yeah, I do think so. I do think that companies are interested in getting sort of publicity in Germany or get known in Germany. So mm. Yes, I would agree. Yes, we feel that there is. I mean, when we as a German news organization call up at some company, it's not like maybe in the past it's been, oh, who are you? Well, we don't deal with Germany a lot, so we don't care for an interview or anything. But now if you call them and say, yeah, we're interested in that, and we want to know what you think about us, and do we want to make our case in Germany as well? Yeah, I would agree.
Mm. How much of your day-to-day also is let's say, transmitting also good German stories from here? And it's not just because, you know, we do something, but, you know, if suddenly BMW is investing more money to make more minis in this market or whatever it may be, is that also a good part of also, you know, feeding the Deutschland Incorporated machine as well?
You mean the other way around?
Yes,
I mean,
exactly.
To tell the German story in Britain.
Yes, well.
not so much. I mean, yes, you're right with BMW, with the car industry. That is often an example for us to do a report, because that is a point where you see cooperation between Germans and the British. So that's a good example of showing how cooperation works in Europe and how these countries can work together and produce great things, not only cars.
Mm.
And so, yeah.
And from a cultural perspective, too, how has the Goethe Institute's program had to change? And again, this is not just what happens in London, but if one was in Washington, also certainly we've covered just all of the work that the Goethe Institute is doing in Africa as well. Is there more sophistication to the program as well? Maybe it had to be a little bit more sort of 1.0 in the beginning. But it's also become a little bit more nuanced as well in terms of how you actually program for those coming in who want to, explore and dive into German culture, learn the German language.
You mean internationally or
yeah,
London?
Not just London, but even internationally.
Well, in general, we focus on contemporary German culture. This is this is one of the main issues of the Goethe Institute, to convey an all-around image of Germany by providing information on its culture, society, and politics, and focusing on things which are actually happening. And I think the politics has changed a lot. And I used to work in New York before I came to London, and New York and London, these are cities where it's not easy at all to get some visibility with the programs we are doing, because there's so much competition from all the cultural institutes, from all the cultural organizations within London. But what we found out, if we do things, for example, in partnership with other organizations, then there is some visibility. We did a very nice program at the beginning of January called The Big Swap, and it meant our French friends, and we celebrated the 50th anniversary of the signing of the Élysée Treaty, and the Institut Français, they offered German cultural programs and we offered French cultural programs, which was really nice, round tables, theater round tables, discussions on contemporary German art and all that. And that was nice. So we like to go into this direction and to focus the European aspect as well.
Finally, gentlemen, just before we go, Frank, I'll start with you. In your day-to-day job, if there's one stereotype that gets on your nerves that you would like to break down and feel it's your job as a journalist as well to correct the Brits or the Americans, whoever it is, what do you find is a little bit grating and getting a bit tired as a German stereotype?
Well, some British people tend to think of us as a bit rude, because we tend to say what we think at the moment and not talk around it too much.
Right.
And sometimes it's what I find a bit sad, because we don't mean it that way. We don't want to be rude. We just want to get things done.
Uwe?
Well, Actually, I think there's always some truth in every stereotype. And my impression here is that British people, the people who know a little bit of Germany, they know that many of the things they think are not as hard or not as bad or ridiculous as they think. I think, for example, this notion that the Germans are always the first at the beach, it is true, I think, maybe just a little anecdote. We produced a towel a couple of years ago with the slogan "Learn German, be the first at the beach." this worked very well here in Britain. So I think my experience and the experience of our colleagues at the Institute is not that there is this German bashing going on, and the stereotypes, there's always some truth in it.
Mm. What do you think, Tyler?
Oh, well, we could devote the whole program to this. But, you know, I think also people, you know, as you said, I think the stereotypes that do exist are also some of the attractions as well. The sense that things are going to work, they are going to run on time, the doors will close with a reassuring thud, whether it's an apartment or whether it's a fine vehicle. Maybe airports in Berlin don't open up quite on time. Gentlemen, Frank Jahn, ARD Television's correspondent here in London, Uwe Rau, Deputy Director of the Goethe-Institut. Schönes Wochenende.
Vielen Dank.
Thank you.
You are listening to Midori House. Coming up in a moment, we're going to review the week's news with our editors. It is 18:48 here in London. You're listening to Midori House.
If you've ever wondered how the shirt on your back came into being, or the roof over your head, the chair you sit on, the laptop you tap on, the office you work in, the train, plane, car, boat, bicycle and lift that transport you, the phone you talk on, or even the bath that you soak in. If you want to know about the things that you live with, then tune into Section D, Monocle 24's weekly dip into the world of design. Premiering each Tuesday at 1900 hours London time, we hop from front row to back street, workshop to fairground, taking in the latest in the worlds of architecture, fashion, retail, transport, technology and graphics. If you want to know how design impacts your daily life and who the people are dedicated to making life better, then pull up a pew and tune in.
Section D with Hugo MacDonald, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Studio One here at Midori House. You are listening to Midori House. It's at just 18:49 in London. It is 11 minutes away till the weekend officially starting, at least for me anyway. Now, as we are at the end of the week, it means it's time to cast our eyes back over the past 7 days. I don't want to say that I'm sick of looking at you, Andrew Tuck, but my God, have we been joined at the hip for the last 2 weeks. We returned to London on Tuesday morning after our big tour of the Asia-Pacific region. Which was great. I'm also joined in the studio by our producer, Gillian De Bison, but I haven't seen you in ages.
No,
so,
I know. So
lovely seeing
you. You left me behind.
I did. Also, you were supposed to be part of the advance team. You were supposed to go out to Australia for the holidays. It didn't happen. You ended up staying here. If we look back over the past week, though, Andrew, what's standing out to you, aside from looking for a good night's sleep when you got back on Tuesday night?
I was struck how the day job of the prime ministers around the world these days is as much about lobbying as it is about kind of looking after their nations. And we've seen two good examples of that this week. We've seen Cameron in India really trying to kind of do everything from sell arms to persuade Indians that actually we're not going to kind of shut the door in all of their faces, especially if they're students. And there's one figure which actually did kind of really jump out at me, which is that the Indian consulate, the British consulate in India, deals with 400,000 visa applications a year through one office, and 9 out of 10 of those are granted. So this is the kind of the battleground, because many Indians do feel that they're kind of given a really kind of rubbish treatment when they come here, but an amazing figure. And then we saw the same with the French president, François Hollande. He went to Athens, and then they had this amazing coup by the journalists where they went on strike for the day when he was there, so they didn't quite cover what he was there to do. But again, selling arms, selling trade, you know, it's a good lobbying job for a good PM these days.
Mm. Gillian, what's your week look like?
I'm definitely in a film mood at the moment. And so I was interested at all the pre-Oscar coverage, which, you know, for ages have been so much about the frocks and quite superficial. And actually, I think this year there's some amazing films, and they're grown-up films, and they're films for grown-ups. And I think the coverage has reflected that. Mm. And I've been really interested.
And so
you're
referencing, I mean, there was a very good piece in yesterday's Wall Street Journal, but just, you know, the politicization and what's become of Zero Dark 30. And, you know, and I've been looking at, you know, stories that other networks have been covering today, you know, has this been bad news for women, et cetera, et cetera.
But also the fact that the Washington Post and the Wall Street Journalist are writing about it. And it's not just the LA Times fashion pages. And they're looking at how the senators are. And sometimes it's almost getting involved in the backing and the supporting of films. But sometimes it's also, you know, turning on the you know, the controversy that's going to do the Oscars no favors, because Oscars don't like controversy.
Right. It's odd also how maybe because we were away, though. It's I also feel that there's always, as you said, this sort of fluffy buildup. But curiously, the Oscar story this year has been in other parts of the newspaper. And maybe also I feel that we've been, I don't know, maybe the news hasn't been catching up with us, Andrew, or something like because we've been a step ahead.
We've been casting our votes at 30,000 feet.
Exactly. All kinds of great films on Cathay Pacific's in-flight program. Andrew, anything else aside from what we've seen on a prime ministerial and presidential level?
A story which, you know, obviously has been on all the pages this week, which is not normally our territory, but I just thought I'd mention it, which is that, you know, the Oscar Pistorius story. And the reason I mention it is because I've never seen anything really done like a TV drama. Mm. You know, the lighting almost of the courthouse. It was like something out of a TV series, and the way he was dressed, the access to him, the way that the cameras were pushed in his face. It was a very strange piece of drama.
Mm. Part of it because we haven't really heard him speak. So there was this, you know, everything mm. via the lawyer. I said this. Yeah, in your face access, but I wonder, you know, how much it was just a little bit, just, you know, just the chaos, and that here you had, you know, I mean, here you had a city which was not prepared for the international media circus, and despite, you know, all we hear about, you know, bureau cutbacks and things like that, if you're going to have, you know, correspondents in Southern Africa, they're going to be around the corner in Johannesburg.
But correspondents who are used to writing about completely different stories, like,
well,
they're not used to writing, you know, it's like the Posh and Beck kind of coverage that you might get here, and suddenly these hard correspondents, you know.
Well, it's been interesting, sort of, you know, seeing Sky News as Africa correspondent who, you know, has really been, you know, blazing into Tripoli, you know, and elsewhere, and these people that we've been seeing in Bamako, and then suddenly you're in a county courthouse.
Yeah, amazing seeing these huge, big heavyweights kind of suddenly covering what seems to be a kind of a potential alleged murder trial. But the other thing I was just going to say about it does lift a little bit of a lid on South African policing. So we've seen the prosecuting policeman accused of murder, which is extraordinary.
Mm. Well, this is what I was going to say, which is quite remarkable. I want to turn onto a bit of a business note as well. I want to invite in one of our other colleagues. One is sneaking in at the moment. You heard the door open and close, but we're not going to come to him right now. We also have our fashion editor, Takaharu Sato, is on the line from Milan, who's been covering Milan Women's Fashion Week right now. Hello, Take, how are you?
Hello, I'm here. Good, thank you.
Good. Very quickly, what's the mood been like in Milan this week? If you can distill it in terms of how buyers are feeling and what direction is women's fashion going to be taking for next winter?
I just wanted to talk about the autumn winter style, it was quite interesting to see all the brands are getting less blingy than they used to be. It's very obvious, and it's certainly reflecting this, you know, your whole European economy, and it's just like all the, you know, wherever I went, like at the showrooms and, you know, presentations or like a catwalk shows, and, you know, I didn't see like many flashy things anymore. I thought that was quite interesting. I just wanted to highlight it first.
And does that mean a somber mood, or does this mean more that that fashion brands have really, yeah, they want maybe more sure bets. They want more wearable clothes. Is that really the reflection?
Yeah, I think so. That's certainly the reflection. And when I spoke to lots of PRs, and they just wanted to say sort of, you know, like people want to sort of go for all the buyers and, of course, the customers on the shop floors. So like they want to go for like more believable clothes and products because they want to like buy a certain thing which they can trust in terms of quality.
Mm.
And so that you can, you know, repeat the same clothes. Like you can wear the same clothes like season after season.
So yes, unlike you, the fashion editor who's been with us for 6 years has never worn the same outfit twice. Take, I'm going to leave you to get on with your Friday evening in Milan. David Michon has also popped into studio as well. David.
Hello, Mr. Boulay.
What late-breaking news do you have for us?
We're talking about Monday, actually. We're jumping ahead across the weekend to talk about a bit of a refresh of on the airwaves of Monocle 24. So just a few kind of new highlights to the station. We're having a revamped Pacific shift, so from 8 to 10 p.m., from 2,100 hours to 2,200 hours, which is 1,500 to 1,600 in New York, and Rio just an hour later than that. You can hear highlights from some of the programs for the day, jump ahead and preview of the next day's programs, and some discussions with our editors about the programming on the station. So.
And
much livelier.
Yes, I was going to say, Andrew, also we're making our newsreaders work harder as well, are we not?
They've got to stick around. We're doing a new 12 midnight bulletin here out of London.
Right.
And that's going to be something good. And we're also, all the news shows are getting new elements. There's new stings. There's new promos. It's all going to be exciting on Monday. There may even be balloons.
There could be balloons as well. But part of it also, we thought it was very important when we do that. Anyone does the Monocle Daily, we always sort of feel we leave our listeners sort of drop off a cliff and then we throw them to the newsroom of the ABC. In Melbourne. So there'll be sort of a gentle handover, but as you're saying, there's a lot more on the horizon as well. Also, there's been a lot of sort of taping and plotting of the office. I mean, Andrew said he looked like a crime scene the other day, but it was just our Yoshi Takagi who was measuring out the new studios that we're currently getting up and running in Japan. Jillian Tobias, Andrew Tuck, David Michon, thank you very much for coming. And today's show is produced by Hannah Jenkins. Our researchers were Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Annabelle Bly, and Barbara Finio. Studio manager has been Chris Fitch today. Up next is The Menu with the very lovely Finnish Marcus Hippie. And there's a bit of a Venezuelan theme in 3 hours' time at 2200 here in London. Emma Nelson and Andrew Muller are back with the Monocle Daily. Midori House is here same time next week. And I'm here at The Stack tomorrow morning. Have a good weekend. Goodbye.